The headlines, Lebanese truck drivers blocking roads in several cities as part of a transport sector strike to protest rising petrol prices and worsening economic conditions. Iran and Syria form a new joint committee aimed at expanding economic cooperation. The U.S. calls for new U.N. Security Council sanctions on North Korea following its recent missile tests. Welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, as we start with Lebanon, where people are protesting in several cities against worsening economic conditions. The land transport sector is staging a strike action, as you can see in these images we received from Beirut today. Demonstrators are using trucks to block roads there. Many public places, schools, and universities are closed. They're protesting growing petrol prices and a plummeting value of the local currency. There's also skyrocketing inflation. Lebanon's economic meltdown began 2 years ago. The crisis has pushed a large segment of the population into poverty, with UN estimating that 4 in 5 Lebanese can be considered poor. Also, Washington's so-called Caesar sanctions on Syria have choked off Lebanon's economy. The secondary sanctions punish any firms that have financial transactions with Syria. Meantime, a political deadlock among the country's leaders has worsened the situation. Well, for more on that, we're now joined by journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who's joining us from Brussels. Mr. Magnier, welcome to the program. First of all, I'd like to get to your initial perspective on the recent protests that are taking place in Lebanon and what has led to what we're seeing today.
Thank you for having me. Actually, what's happening in Lebanon started in 2019 when the local currency dropped from 1,500 Lebanese lira for the dollar and has reached today 33,000, transforming more or less 70 to 80% of the Lebanese citizen into a poverty level. That is due mainly to the sanctions that were imposed by the Americans on Syria in the first place, and secondly, by drying up the foreign currency from Lebanon and the manipulation of the local banks in response to the U.S. request. And the aim of the Americans was to accuse Hezbollah of being responsible of the deterioration of the financial situation and perhaps, hopefully, turn the population against Hezbollah so the Americans can achieve what Israel failed to achieve in the last years since 2006, when Israel declared war on Lebanon. That is the main reason. Secondly, the president of the country, President Michel Aoun, has been trying to galvanize the multiple sectarian factions to hold the national dialogue conference. However, only the allies of President Aoun responded, and all the other opponents said such conference can happen, but only after May parliamentary election. And that has specific purpose, because what the American and the European, mainly France, are hoping to do to see is to make sure that all the NGOs that they have been supporting, and we're talking about several thousand, would make sure that they have enough support to gain votes in the parliament and snap away the majority from President Aoun and his allies, including Hezbollah, Amal, and other Sunni and Druze parties. And they believe by holding the majority, they can turn the table against Hezbollah and then claim the necessity for Hezbollah to surrender its weapons so Lebanon can join all the Arab states who declared normalization of the relationship with Israel. Bottom line, that is grosso modo what's happening in Lebanon.
Mr. Magnier, let's look at this in the bigger picture regionally, if you may. Who benefits from this uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
Well, first of all, Israel, because it's important for Israel to see Hezbollah diverting its attention from what's happening on the borders, and also by the intention of the Israelis to take part of the Lebanese oil, and we're talking about the maritime dispute between Lebanon and Israel, that there are delegations talking about it since over a decade now. Secondly, the Americans who want Lebanon to join the normalization club, let's say the Arab club of normalization with Israel. And third, they want to drop the Palestinian cause and the oppressed Palestinian population that has no right to return, and Israel expansion in Palestine. Fourth is the Arab countries who are against Hezbollah and against Iran, but they can't direct their weapons against Iran because Iran is a state and it's a very powerful one and has the capacity to defend itself and has many resources, while Lebanon doesn't. Lebanon rely mainly on foreign support, regional support, and tourism, etc., and all that has been deprived now. Who is benefiting from all that is the general hegemony of the U.S. that is trying to impose it on the Middle East since decades.
Thanks a lot, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Well, an event has been held in Lebanon to mark 6 years since the execution of Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Bahar al-Nimr by Saudi Arabia. Panayam Saleh reports from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
On the 6th anniversary of the martyrdom of prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Bahar al-Nimr, who was executed by the Saudi regime, a group formed at the initiation of a union of opposition members in the Arab Peninsula held its first meeting in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Dr. Fuad Ibrahim, a Saudi opposition academic, told Press TV that this is a platform for a new political organization.
This occasion could be considered as a platform for a new political organization that will start to build up a political discourse and a political agenda in the coming days. And it's just a starting point for a group that has been working for a long time but without political identity.
In an address to the event, head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashem Safiyuddin, stressed that no power in the world can stand in the face of the voices which support the oppressed and the victims of unjust rule of the Saudi family.
One thing is clear, Saudi Arabia needs to stop the policy of bullying other Arab and Islamic states. They spend lots of money against the interest of the people of the Arab Peninsula. The money is spent to hatch further conspiracies against Palestine and Al-Quds. Saudi Arabia and its allies have failed to achieve their goals in the region.
Sayyid Safiyuddin also demanded that the Saudi regime stop pumping money only to sow discord and sedition in Lebanon and across the Arab world. The Yemeni nationals at the meeting stressed that it is the time to tell the Saudis that enough is enough.
The blood of 500,000 martyrs that was shed in Yemen encourages us to do whatever in our power to liberate Mecca and Medina and get rid of Saudi rulers. We had been under Saudi aggression for 70 years, but Imam Khomeini and his support gave us the courage to stand against our enemy.
The problem of the region, the participants say, is not merely an issue of unemployment or lack of services for certain communities in the Arab Peninsula, but rather the presence of a state which meddles in other states' affairs. The Muslim clerics believe the Wahhabi ideology of the Saudi rulers is not only persecuting the people of other sects, but is also distorting the true image of Islam by spreading false ideologies. Analysts believe there is a growing conviction that the tyranny of the Saudi regime will lead to a downfall, while the people of the Persian Gulf Arab states who have endured persecution will one day find their way towards self-rule and freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Welcome back. Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development has paid a 3-day visit to Syrian capital Damascus for talks on mutual ties. Heading an economic and political delegation, Rostam Qasemi met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to discuss issues of bilateral interest. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has more in this report.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
South Korea can now pay an overdue compensation to an Iranian investor group after receiving sanctions exemption from Washington. South Korea's foreign ministry says it obtained a specific license from the Treasury Department to make the transaction using the U.S. financial system. Seoul has to pay more than $60 million to an Iranian investor group over a 2015 dispute related to a Daewoo Electronics deal. So far, it has been unable to make the payments because Washington applies secondary sanctions to firms that do business with Iran. This has also led to South Korea blocking $7 billion of Iranian funds for several years. Over a week ago, a top delegation of Korean diplomats traveled to Vienna to hold talks with the negotiators working to revive the 2015 deal with Iran. The United States is now urging the UN Security Council to penalize North Korea over its latest missile launches. After imposing its own new sanctions, U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield says all of Pyongyang's ballistic missile launches since September last year violate UNSC resolutions. Right before making the call for UN action, the U.S. Treasury Department revealed new sanctions on some North Korean and Russian individuals and entities. North Korea has fired two hypersonic missiles in the past week, and for the first time in 2 years, leader Kim Jong-un personally watched Tuesday's launch. Pyongyang argues that it needs those tests to boost its self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. And fresh developments out of Kazakhstan, where the situation has calmed down following a bloody bout of violence that lasted days. Foreign peacekeepers are now leaving the country. Over 2,000 troops from several countries are loading their equipment onto Russian military planes for a trip back home. A hike in energy prices led to public protests that were peaceful initially, but soon turned out of control and became deadly. The government resigned and fuel price caps were restored, but continued unrest prompted a call for foreign security help from President Kasym Tokayev and the subsequent deployment of Russian-led forces. The president calls the unrest a coup attempt and believes it was mostly induced from outside. He visited Almaty on Wednesday and promised to restore damage to the oil-rich city. Nearly 10,000 people were arrested and dozens killed, including rioters and police, during the 10-day turmoil. And an Indian-controlled Kashmir, New Delhi has declared around 70 hectares of land as strategic areas, paving the way for armed forces to control the area. India calls it a routine exercise. However, people of Kashmir see it as the fallout of scrapping Kashmir's special status in August 2019. Our correspondent, Shana Bhatt, reports.
In the first of its kind since the Control of Building Operations Act 1988 and the Jammu and Kashmir Development Act 1970 amended in 2020, the Indian government has issued a notification declaring around 70 hectares of Kashmir lands as strategic areas. The land has been notified at Kashmir's international ski destination Gulmarg and tourist hotspot Sonmarg in the northern and central Kashmir. As per the amendments to the land laws in 2020, the government can notify strategic areas for use by the armed forces and regulate construction through a special dispensation. While Indian authorities in Kashmir say it is a routine exercise, the political bandwagon of Kashmir has highly criticized India for this move. Pro-India politicians took to Twitter to denounce the move.
We have challenged the abrogation of 370. It is pending before the Honorable Supreme Court of India. Whatever laws you have come up with from 5th of August, implemented them in Jammu and Kashmir, those are illegal, those are unconstitutional. The Supreme Court of India will hear it one day. I'm sure Honorable Supreme Court of India will give justice to the people of Jammu and Kashmir and they will uphold the constitution of this country. Constitution of this country cannot be run on the advice of a, or on the whims and fancies of a ruling party or of a party which has a brute majority.
While the local politicians of Kashmir are crying foul over India's move of allotment of land to its army for strategic purposes, the people in Indian-administered Kashmir seem unsatisfied with the government's approach post-abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
The government seems busy with all sorts of changes in Kashmir, except for what matters to the people of Kashmir. Unemployment, healthcare, economy and education, all the sectors seem to be in shambles.
Indian-controlled Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone, and the longest-pending demand of people here has been demilitarization. Before the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party took the reins of India in its hands, the military presence in the residential areas of the disputed region was decreased as a part of confidence-building measures. But during the years of BJP rule, the security presence in and around the Muslim-majority Kashmir has been increased many folds.
Since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, Kashmir's employment rate has slipped to ever lowest. People of the region say promises made before and after August 2019 have turned out to be eyewash. Observers say each and every step that has been taken so far seems to strengthen India's military presence in this geostrategic territory. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Cornelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing State and Capitalism, directed by Jacob Tremblay. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of the political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Wright, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labour Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Rice, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact.
I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power.
People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it. The old assumption has been that the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active. Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, specifically on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping, and Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. But the central idea of the fact that, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Wright's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Wright emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war. in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so. But I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Wright makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned. And sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Reagan as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard. And he said, you know, my only regret is I didn't push harder. The irony is, he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realise the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
No, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary actually, and how sort of downspirited he becomes. But also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just, you know, now the general average person in America has no power really politically, which is quite a shocking thing to say, but when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, that's kind of how it's working. And but you see little, you know, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
Yeah, strong argument to be made in the film, and of course aided by great animation sequences and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong. All over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah,
what we're beginning to see is that it's actually anti-establishment versus establishment.
Yeah.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, whether there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can we just make...
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again? Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him actually on this issue. And do you think Reich has all that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he is Democrat, so he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And, it's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was the early elections when they were filming this documentary, and the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that.
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly, and we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so, corporate influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So, you know, the civil, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests. And the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue, or Democrat to Republican, or vice versa, is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama. We've seen it with Trump. And should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavour. And I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive.
So Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out, like, through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just kind of eating itself, and it's very much it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality, to where the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
It's not surprising, but it kind of helps
you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how, or how it's affecting them. This kind of helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps helps you, gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of film does. It might get people to stand up and say, "Wait a minute, something
happened." It's an empowering documentary. Yeah.
And there's a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing, and there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, we're kind of repeating history. So.
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas, and then my phone bill, I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
That was a truly heartbreaking scene to watch there. And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories of McDonald's worker and also sort of farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living, and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Wright raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. And it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money. It's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans,
exactly.
And of course,
so that
never
just exacerbates
debt.
It. So this process inevitably, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees, and basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's. But it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset. And the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of understanding...
At least it's a good starting point, yeah.
I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own life.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Wright earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
It's just, you know, watching the system get worse and worse, and he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated. And you saw him, like, in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And, of course, he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month for treatment. But for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment.
What is the alternative to receiving the chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
You would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. I find that really disturbing. But, I mean, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Because they're utilities, they're something everybody has to have. And it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits and put people, you know, make people poor.
Did you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. Rockefeller was, one of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman, and he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published, but it's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up.
That is very worrying indeed. And just as we end near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, Rich, do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better, it's getting worse. So,
just your final thoughts in the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on, and maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there, but I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Kunila Shambayaki.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Allah, Allah. Sheikh Kazem Ali.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. I welcome you all to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program for humanity, and today's topic is Hollywood, conditioning of the subconscious mind and the extermination of the human rights. We have discussed earlier that some of the fundamental elements of human rights are right to live and right to choose. However, imagine an organized and structured way through which one of our essential elements of human rights is negated and exterminated without even we realizing about it. And that is our right to choose. Let me give you a little introduction to our discussion before we dive deep into it. Very briefly, there's a book called Miraj al-Saada by Mullah Ahmad Naraqi, and it has been concised by Sheikh Abbas Akummi. And Sheikh Abbas Akummi is the same author who has written Mafatihul Jinan, who has compiled Mafatihul Jinan. Sheikh Abbas Akummi writes in his book, which is the concise version of Miraj al-Saada, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed us with four faculties. One is Shahwat, the other one is Ghazab, Waham, and Aql. If I translate these terms, they turn into greed, anger, fantasy, and logic. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that let logic rule all the other faculties. If this happens, then you would never go wrong, you would never go astray, and you will make the best and the most correct right choices. However, if any one of the other faculties gain control of the throne, that is greed, anger, or fantasy, and they tend to rule the human being, then the man will find himself making wrong choices and going astray unless he purifies himself and gets the Aql to come back and take the throne again. It is only under the rule of Aql that man can progress right and attain that Sa'adat and Kamal that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prescribed for us. Now let's look at Hollywood. Let's look at the music industry. Let's look at the pop culture. What faculties do they target? What faculties are their area of focus? What faculties do they try and enhance? Do they have movies that target our faculty of Aql? Or do they have movies that target our faculty of Shahwat, Ghazab, and Waham? Look at some of the movies. Look at James Bond. Look at Fast and Furious. Look at Thor. Look at Captain America. Look at Superman, Harry Potter. All these movies target either Shahwat, Ghazab, or Waham. Or look at their music, right from heavy metal to pop and to ballads and rap. All of them target just these three faculties, that is Shahwat, Ghazab, and Waham. Meaning that they are strengthening our specific faculties so that it would be beneficial for them, so that we choose what they want us to choose and not what a true, pure logic would want to choose. Look at all the list of cartoons that they have for our children. Do they enhance the logic of our children, or does it target their Shahwat, Ghazab, and Waham? Look at Power Rangers. It's all about fighting. Look at Ninja Turtles. Every time they face a problem, the only solution they have, the only methodology they have to solve the problem is by fighting and killing and destroying the opponents. They do not follow the method of dialogue, a logical approach to sit down, discuss, and solve the problem. The only approach that they have is hit, fight, and kill. Look at Spider-Man, look at Batman, or look at Justice League. On the other hand, look at other cartoons that are focused and targeted to our little daughters, like Barbie or Nancy or Peppa Pig.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
These cartoons are designed in a way that they're focused on enhancing either shahwat, ghazab, or wahm, the greed in our children to have more, to have better, to have much, much more than what they already have, to discard what they have early and look for better and greater things. So essentially, they are trampling the human rights of the children right from their childhood. If you look at the Hollywood, they're targeting the human rights of the grown-ups by conditioning their subconscious mind and making them, or in a way, the term may not fit exactly right here, but then in a way forcing them to choose and behave in a way that they want us to behave. Look at all the advertisements that you see during your television shows. Some advertisements are focused on drinks, and some advertisements are focused on picking a particular brand of laundry, particular brand of clothing, particular brand of washing machine, or particular brand of lawn mowers. And all these are designed with the intention of making you choose what they want you to choose and not what you truly want to choose. Inshallah, in the coming episodes, we will deal in much greater detail looking at the various experiments they have conducted to arrive at this conclusion, conducting various experiments right from the grown-ups to the elderly, to the youth, to the youngsters, and even the teens, or to the extent of children. When I say children, we're not talking about children who are 8, 9, or 10. We're talking about children who are 6 months old to 2 years old, and capturing their behavior, looking at their behavior, monitoring their behavior, calling in psychologists to sit down and analyze their behavior so that they would truly understand what would impact them, what would impact their personality, what would impact their choices, and using these psychologists to design methods, design movies, design cartoons, design advertisements to influence the choice of the kids, to influence the subconscious mind of the kids, to influence the subconscious mind of the grown-ups, to condition the subconscious mind in a way that we choose exactly what they want us to choose, however we think we are choosing with our free will. And this is what I would point out and say, that this is what is extermination of the human rights, because they are taking away our right to choose, our right to live freely. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, you are there. When the Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair, and grieved in his heart were the words of his Lord. To all of mankind this was his call. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify Allah. Of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is his messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.